Starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Start today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Gimme Some Sugar. Then I do an extended interview with KP. I met her at the New Spirit Recovery Center in Encino. And then a short story by Sherry Cohen, a few words about Christmas. Stay tuned!
Sugar plays an integral part in the life of every Southerner. We were all introduced to it early in our lives, having put it on our Kellogg's cornflakes from the age of two. When Tony the Tiger told us that sugar frosted flakes were great, we believed him, heart and soul. Would Tony lie to us? Sugar frosted flakes, Cocoa Puffs, Honey Cheerios, Trix, the list went on and on. The cereal aisle at the Piggly Wiggly grocery store was the scene of many a great mother-child argument. In the South, a child's first three words that are learned are in this order, Mama, Dada, and Coke. That brown sugar water from the Candler family in Atlanta is the mother's milk of Southern youth. The sugar and caffeine of our youth was a pale imitation of the days when Coca-Cola contained cocaine. November 6, 1984 was a day that will reign in infamy in the carbonated soft drink industry in America. That was the day that the Coca-Cola Company substituted high fructose corn syrup for cane sugar in Coca-Cola in the USA. Mexico would not allow this substitution. If you want to know what the soft drink of my youth tasted like, you must get a Mexican Coke. On a hot August day, drink about half the Mexican Coke, then pour a package of Planters peanuts into the Coke bottle. We called that the redneck parfait. As children, if we were hungry, we would make a sugar sandwiches. Two slices of light bread, I never had a slice of whole wheat bread until I left home, slathered in Duke's mayonnaise, then covered liberally with sugar. That would hold off the hunger pains until supper time. When asked for something, you would say please, then pretty please, and lastly, pretty please with sugar on top. Is it any wonder that the southeastern part of the United States is the diabetic capital of America? My mother's youngest brother was my Uncle Billy. Uncle Billy was my favorite uncle. He always brought me a gift when he came to visit. He lived with us for a while when he was in college. He graduated from Mercer University and went to work for the Dixie Crystal Sugar Company in Savannah, Georgia. Uncle Billy married one of the belles of Savannah society, Suzanne Gerald. Suzanne was stunningly beautiful and came from an old, respectable Savannah family. Uncle Billy was clearly batting out of his league. In Atlanta, they say, "What do you do?" In Macon, they say, "What does your daddy do?" And in Savannah, they say, "What would you like to drink?" When I was about 9 years old, Uncle Billy took me to the Dixie Crystal's sugar refinery in Savannah. I saw ocean-going freighters unloading raw sugar made from sugarcane into massive storage facilities where front-end loaders with 10-cubic-yard buckets moved the raw sugar around like it was sand. The raw sugar was refined in the plant and came out white, where it was bagged in 5, 10, 20, or 100-pound bags, mostly granular, some powdered, with some brown sugar for bakers. The last time I visited this sugar refinery, it was the second largest one in the United States. In 2008, the Dixie Crystal Sugar Refinery exploded, killing 14 people. Who knew that sugar would explode? Apparently, sugar dust will ignite like gunpowder. Uncle Billy and Aunt Suzanne were both insulin-dependent diabetics, as were all of my mom's brothers and sisters. So are most of my cousins on my mom's side of the family. My mom's father was an insulin-dependent diabetic. Granddaddy was blind because of diabetes. As a result of this, his wife, my grandmother, we all call Mama Lily, sweetened her tea with saccharin. If sweet tea is the table wine of the South, Mama Lily's was the vin ordinaire or the two-buck chuck of tea. She said it was because of Granddaddy, but once he was dead and gone, she still used saccharin because it was cheaper than sugar. Mama Lily was a little tight with the dollar. She had a son that worked for Dixie Crystal and could get her sugar in 100-pound bags cheap, but not as cheap as saccharin. Mama Lily had lived through the Great Depression, and she was never going to be broke or hungry again. We all had to suffer through her tea sweetened with saccharin. Her fried chicken, however, compensated for the saccharin-sweetened tea. A child in the South knows better than to walk into a room full of older women relatives like Aunt Inez, Aunt Maudie, Aunt Dady Mae, and Aunt Laurel. The entire room would erupt with a chorus of, "Give me some sugar," and the older lady folks would pull at you and hug your neck and kiss you on the face and neck. I hated it. All the aunties smelled of Cody body powder and cheap Evening in Paris eau de toilette. Lots of comments about how I'd grown since they had last seen me. Better to run into them at the meal when everyone had a plate of fried food and a glass of sweet tea, when the hugging and kissing was almost impossible. In Reynolds, Georgia, there is a cafe that serves a good breakfast and lunch. The Cotton Gin Cafe and Inn provides sustenance and a place to stay for deer hunters and other travelers that happen to need a place to stay. They open at 6 a.m. Their grits are good, the bacon fried, and the eggs cooked to perfection in the bacon grease, and the coffee is strong. The place is staffed with middle-aged waitresses that dote on the customers, calling everyone sweetie, honey, and darling. The last time I was there, pre-pandemic, my coffee was delivered, and there was no sugar on the table. I asked Lurleen, the waitress, for some sugar, and her reply was, "Where do you want it?" with a coquettish grin on her middle-aged face. I just pointed to my cheek and said, "Right here will be fine."
It's November 19th, 2021. I'm with KP at New Spirit Recovery. Hi, KP.
Hello.
Well, would you like to start by telling about that first experience with music meditation?
Well, it all first started, like, the music was slower, and then it was slow and soft, and then kind of went into, like, a darker tone. And I first saw a castle and then a woman, like, dressing up into, like, battle gear, but it was real slow, like almost in, like, slow motion. And then it would go back to, like, a darkness, like there was an evil coming, and then back to her getting ready, and it went back and forth like that for a little bit. And then all of a sudden, like, the darkness came over, and it was just death everywhere. Like, they'd lost the battle, and there was just death everywhere. And then...
You're seeing this in your mind.
Yes, in my mind. And then eventually it got a little happier, but in a bittersweet sort of way. I tried to find my ancestors in the music and try to feel them with the music and the beat and through the ground and the earth, and they came to me, and I first saw my grandma and grandpa, who passed when I was younger, my dad's parents, and they were just looking down on me, smiling and touching my heart. And then I saw another friend, B, who passed away a couple of years ago from cirrhosis of the liver, and she was a really amazing soul, an amazing, beautiful lady, amazing mother, and just an all-around wonderful, great friend. And then I saw Nate, who was a friend who had, unfortunately, what we thought took his own life due to alcohol and just a constant struggle of depression and blaming himself for several things that happened in his past. And and then I saw my grandpa, who just passed away last year in 2020, and that one was the one that hit me the hardest. He looked down at me, and he had this this big gap tooth in his on his smile, and just like that grin he always gave. We all call it the grin, because it looked like he was up to no good. And then I put my hand out, and I could feel his hand on me, and I could, like, just see the wrinkles in his hands and just feel it on my hand. And they were all telling me to just, like, let go, and that everything's gonna be okay, and that I can push through this, and that they're all proud of me. And so at one point, all their hands were on my heart, and it just, like, I remember laying down on the ground here, and just, like, my arms were stretched out while I'm on the yoga mat, and then just I could just feel all this energy in my heart from all these people that had passed away, and just friends and family that I just so cared dearly about. And it was a really, really amazing experience. It was something I'll never, ever forget. And the whole time, I'm just, tears are rolling down my face. And just the fact that I could feel my grandpa's hand again was the most amazing thing ever. And I could see his hand and just see his face and his smile and just him telling me that it's okay and it's time to let go and that I'm strong and I can get better and recover and just be happy and live my life. So that was my first experience with you.
So I was playing this music. It was rather beautiful but somber, and it just drew mm-hmm. you into this whole world, really. And do you feel like the people, the beings that were there, was this just in your imagination, or do you feel like there was really, like, this is them as angels, this is really their presence coming to you?
Yeah, I definitely felt that they were spirits that were coming to me, and they were all good spirits. So there was nothing, no negativity about it. You know, me crying is just because I miss all of them, and but no, I definitely believe that they were very good spirits and just watching over me. And, you know, everybody had, every single one of them had pain in their life and in some way or another. And I think they all just saw how much I was in pain, and they just all came to me and was just telling me that it's okay, and it's okay to let go, and it's okay to move on.
So they talk about guardian angels sometimes, and in this case, maybe these are people who had real struggles in their life,
mm-hmm.
and maybe with addiction, but now they're kind of angels. They're in an angelic place. There's no more suffering.
Right. And some are, you know, more tragic than others. Like Nate, we thought that he killed himself, and he did, but we thought it was intentional. And, you know, he talked about it a lot when I was with him and hung out with him a lot. He talked about it a lot, and how he, like, regretted this one situation where he should have been home at this certain time, and a tragedy struck, and he blamed it on himself. And since then, he was just drinking all the time, and he was really, really depressed. But for me, seeing him as a good spirit made me think that it was an accident of what he did, because I don't think that a bad negative spirit would have come to me like that, especially with my grandparents and my other friend. I mean, they were all of them such great people, but Nate in particular, he had a very, very dark side, and I think he was just very drunk, and it happened by accident. And I don't know if that can be closure for me, because I don't know 100%. I just feel that if he was a good spirit, it wouldn't be anything negative. You know, nothing negative would come out of that, that I would see with him visiting me. So,
what kind of makes you think, like, there is tragedy in this world, and particularly, you know, if you're in a family where there's alcoholism or addiction, or, you know, things are hard, there's tragedy, and people do bad things and stupid things and horrible things even, but it makes you think that there's another world where, I don't know, where all is right or all is forgiven, and it all gets set back to purity and kindness and simplicity. I'm taking that from your...
Yeah, I definitely think that could be, that can be something. I mean, we were all pure at one point, you know, and we all did things and made mistakes and made ourselves unpure in several different ways. And then sometimes those bad, unpure things can catch up to you and unfortunately cause a death. But I think that if you truly are a good person and have a kind-hearted soul, that your soul will live forever, and you'll be set back into that purity again. And I think that's why I saw Nate in particular, just because I knew him deep down more than his brothers did or his own father. I knew him more than anybody probably in his life. Maybe besides his mother, but his mother's there with him now too. And I think that's all he wanted was to be back with his mother and just be there with his mother, because that was the tragedy that he blamed himself for.
Another death of mm-hmm. his mom.
Yes.
That was a guilt and shame he carried around.
Yes.
Pretty heavy burden.
A very heavy burden. And since that happened, he went downhill, and I didn't know him at that time. I met him, actually, I think I met him about a year and a half, maybe not even a year and a half, maybe a year after that tragedy happened. And it was a traumatic experience for him. And he always blamed himself, and I think he just always wanted to be back with his mom and just tell her, like, look, I'm sorry. And maybe that night it was intentional for him to do what he did, but maybe it was an accident. And whatever it was, I just know now that he's back in his pure form with his mom and happy again. He's finally happy. And it sucks that a death has to make somebody happy, but I think in his case it was okay. And maybe he was okay with that.
It was his time to go.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate, it's sad, and it sucks, but I think for him, he knew it was time.
Well, we were talking today about tragedy, and I was saying that, you know, there's tragedy in this world, and it's for some people more than others,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow if we give tragedy and hardship and sadness its moment and let it kind of process through and cry our tears, then it moves. And it's almost like when we avoid pain, when we put it in the closet, when we pretend, then it kind of haunts us, and then it almost can lead to more problems and addictions. Well, it sounds like you had some rough experiences coming up. Can we talk about, like, well, how you ended up here and how you ended up using, I'm sure tragedy, or maybe even from the family, you know, maybe families or whole communities aren't really dealing with pain, and they're dealing with it by drinking or something.
Sure.
So nobody, it never gets solved, and it goes from one generation to the next.
Yeah, I definitely think I am part of that. Growing up for me was good. I had a pretty good childhood. My father has been 26 years sober now, so I never saw him drink, which is a blessing, but it also was kind of a curse too, because him and my mom never really got along very well. I remember being little, my bedroom was right next to theirs, and I just remember listening to them scream all night, almost every night. I could just hear them, and I don't know if they didn't know that I could hear, but it stuck with me, and I just always wondered, like, why do you guys fight all the time? And I remember going out of my room sometimes and asking them, like, why are you guys fighting? And they'd be like, oh, we're not. Go back to bed. We're just talking. And I'm just like, I just remember thinking, like, I don't feel like that's what just talking is, you know? And so I didn't know how to really deal with that. And I noticed that I started getting depressed a lot, and I didn't know what that was either. I was just sad all the time. I would crawl back in my closet, and like right on the walls, they're like carved into the walls. And then as I grew older, I wondered, oh, I wonder if instead of carving into the walls, what if I did it to myself? And maybe then my sadness will go away that way. So I tried doing that and
cutting.
Yeah, cutting myself and just any way I could. I mean, even just like taking a knife and just like stabbing it into my arm and twisting. It was just, and of course it didn't do anything except for leave questions with my mom why there's marks all over my arms and my legs. And just remember telling them, like, yeah, look, I'm sad, like, I'm depressed. And they just didn't, I don't know if it was just a different time then, but they just did not want to hear that. Like, they didn't think depression was real. They thought it was all in your head and just like, oh, you're fine, you're gonna be fine, you know, blah,
just
blah,
get
blah.
Over it.
Yeah, right, just get over it. So
just
then,
feel better.
Right, just feel better. You'll be fine. You'll be good. And
yeah, when, if I could just feel better, I would have already been doing that.
Right.
That's right.
I would have done that a long time ago if I could feel better.
Just feel better. I know. It's so like simple answers for complicated issues.
Right. But when alcohol came into play, you know, I'd seen my aunties and uncles drinking all the time at Christmas parties, birthday parties, Thanksgiving, whatever, you name it, they were drinking. And my dad was still in recovery at this moment. So I, as a kid, I didn't understand why he always wanted to leave these parties so early. But it was because everybody was around him was drinking, and it was so uncomfortable for him. And sometimes at these parties, you know, we'd be at a hotel or something, and my aunties would be sitting by the pool, and I'd be like, hey, I'm thirsty, what's that? And they'd be like, oh, have a sip. You know, 10-year-old me not knowing what's going on, and I'd take it, start drinking it, and my dad would get so mad, and I'd be like, Dad, what's going on? Why are you so mad? I'm just having some of auntie's drink. And he'd say, like, oh, that's for adults, you know, you're not supposed to drink that. And I was just like, whatever, you know. And I was like 10 years old, 12 years old. And then growing up more, I had a rough time with friends and stuff like that, because I have epilepsy as well. So in middle school, I had to do all these testing and wires on my head while going to school and, you know, going to the special ed class and all of that. So the bullying was real hard, and
you got picked on a lot.
I got picked on a lot.
Jeez.
And that
the kid who's having trouble, let's pile it on heavier.
Right.
Let's make it harder for her. Jeez.
The sad kid that doesn't know why they're sad, and their aunties let them drink at a young age, and then I have to deal with all this wires on my head for a whole week at school, getting made fun of constantly because I'm in the special ed class. And just,
jeez.
I mean, I remember I was friends with like the popular crowd, and this one girl, when I got put into special ed, she goes, so how was your retard class today? And it just made me feel like just like, wow, like you're mean. like I'm, you know, yeah, there is something wrong with me, but that makes me different, you know? Like, I'm learning different, and I'm smart. I just am smart in different ways than you are.
That's pretty, pretty mature.
Yeah.
Internal response.
It was middle school. But, so in the middle of middle school, seventh grade-ish, summer going into eighth grade, I was introduced to these guys. It's when I started going into special ed. I met these guys that they didn't have friends, and neither did I. So I wanted to be friends with them, and we just became friends and grew up together, started smoking pot, and then like 13 years old, we started drinking regularly. And you know, since I was the only girl in the group, I'd have to like find older guys to buy drinks for us. So that was kind of weird too, and scary, because you know, I'm 13, 14 years old trying to get booze for me and my boys, and
jeez.
It was like they were using me to get booze, but I wanted to be a part of them, you know? I wanted to fit in, so I was like, oh, okay, I'll smile at this guy, and he'll buy us booze, and then we can go, you know? And me and my other friend Ash did that too. We would, you know, 16 years old, just flirt with a guy just to get booze, and we didn't. Anything could have happened. I mean, anything could have happened. You know, guy's 35 years old. We're 16. Like, so, and into high school, everybody was starting to do drugs. Adderall was really big. We would steal like energy drinks from the stores and sell them to kids at school so we could get weed and alcohol and anything that we could get. Anything. We would steal drugs from our parents. Like, my mom had a knee surgery and I stole all of her Vicodin and snorted it with my friends at school right on a microwave. While school was going and everybody was around there, we just snorted it right up. And surprisingly, I never really got in trouble for any of that. But drinking was a huge thing in that town. It was a small town. There's nothing else to do, drinking and drugs. There's a big heroin and meth scene. So you're either doing drugs or you own a farm or you're a drinker. I fit into the drugs and drinking. And high school, that's all it was. Partying, drinking, trying to fit in, try to get that next high, always trying to find money to get that next high. Never had a solid job in high school. I worked all the time, but never had a solid one. It was just, oh, yep, I get $300 for my paycheck. I'm going to spend it all on alcohol and weed and any type of pills we can find, and let's have a good weekend, guys, you know, and never go back to that job again then. And then after high school, that's when my tragedy kind of started to hit. I graduated high school. I thought I was gonna be doing better. And my father brought me on my graduation present. He brought my brother and sister on a motorcycle trip when they graduated, and it was my turn. And so we went south, we'll just say that. I wanted to visit somebody down south, and he went out, I'll just say, by the ocean. And so I was with my cousin for 2 weeks. He was down in the ocean with his bike for 2 weeks. And he said he was just helping out a friend at a racetrack. And, you know, keep in touch. In 2 weeks, he'll come and pick me up. Great. Cool. Thanks, Dad. This will be fun, you know. And 2 weeks go by. My dad picks me up. And it was super weird because he was, like, giving me money for cigarettes and he would have never, ever done that before, ever. He hated that I smoked, and he would never, ever give me cigarettes. And he gave me $100, and I was like, at that moment, I'm like, okay, something's weird. Like, my dad would never do something like that. Come to find out, my dad asked for a divorce that night that we got home to my mother. And I didn't find out for 2 days later, and I was living with that guy Nate I was talking about earlier. I was living with him, and I didn't find out 2 days later that my dad asked for a divorce, because I ended up having a seizure, and they didn't want to put pressure on me or whatever, or stress me out even more. And then I started figuring stuff out, and I found out that my graduation present, my dad cheated on my mom. So my graduation present was my parents' divorce. And my dad just used me to go down and sleep with this other woman while I was in the South hanging out with my cousin. And it was just the amount of pain and hatred I had for my dad was unbelievable. I, even to this day, it's been almost 10 years now, even to this day, like, I want to love him and I want to forgive him, but I don't think it'll ever happen. And after all that happened, I ended up moving down south, maybe about a year after the divorce. Once I got down there, I turned 21 down there. I was working a ton and I was drinking a ton. I mean, I would get a liter of whiskey every night and drink it all, the whole bottle to myself. Go to work at 10 in the morning, get off work at midnight, do the same thing over and over and over and over and over for months. And that led to me getting even more depressed. And I was having thoughts of suicide again. And I decided one day, I bought a pint of whiskey again, and I drank it, and I was on my skateboard and driving by the highway, and I remember just like looking at down at all these cars driving so fast down on these while I was on the bridge, and I was just like, man, like that's what I'm gonna do. Like, I'm gonna be right there in all those cars. That's what I want right now. And I like started climbing up on this bridge, and out of nowhere my phone rings, and I don't know why, but I pulled it out of my pocket. And it was my cousin. I answered it, and I'm like, what? And she just said, don't f-ing do it. Don't do it. And I was like, what? And she's like, you know what? Just don't do it. And I hung up. And I stepped down, and I started walking away from this bridge. And the freaking hospital was right there, like three blocks away. So I walked down to that hospital and checked myself in, and spent about five to seven days in a mental hospital, and I learned a lot from that. I didn't want to kill myself anymore after that.
That was a little bit of a miracle that she called you.
Yeah, it was.
How did
she know?
I mean, we don't even know. That's like a little angel came down and saved your life out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. It was. As I, you know, when you're in the mindset of you want to kill yourself, you don't care about anything. It's one of the most selfish things you can do, but you don't care. You don't care about who's it going to hurt. You don't care about your family, your friends, your possessions, nothing. All you want is to just be gone, and you just don't want to feel pain anymore. So, yeah, you don't care about anything. All you want to do is you see it, you see the path, and you just want to jump, or you want to, you know, pull the trigger, or, you know, tie that noose around your neck. However it's going to happen, that's what you want, and you don't care about anything else. You just know that you want to die, and you're going to do it. So having that, my cousin called me at that particular time, was just incredible, and I was so pissed off at her for it too. And we had gotten to a fight earlier that day too. She kicked me out of the house. That's why I was wandering around. And so I went through this hospital, didn't want to kill myself anymore, but I was still depressed about my dad and what my dad did to me and how it made me feel. And then the drinking was progressed as always, and I ended up starting to talk to an old friend from high school. We'll call him Jay. So me and Jay started talking more, and he ended up moving down south with me, and we got together, and I thought everything was going to be perfect with him, and it was perfect. And then, so we moved, we lived together down south for about a year and a half together. Then his dad ended up getting really sick back up north. So his dad got sick, so we decided to move back up north because we wanted to spend time with his dad and be there for him. I got a job, and I ended up not liking that job, so I ended up starting to work at this bar called Tease. And
not at a bar.
Yeah.
Around alcohol all the time.
And that's when it started to really, really kick off for me because the people there, you know, the guys in the kitchen, I started off dishwashing and then became a cook, and the guys there were accepting of me and reminded me of like high school again. Like, oh, here's this group of guys and they like me and, you know, they like to drink and I like to drink and like, let's drink. And Jay's dad ended up getting sick though. That's why we moved back up north. And he ended up passing away, so we had broken up. And that was like for a year we were broken up. And during that year, I just went all out. I mean, any guy, here I am, you know? And it was drinking, drugs, lots of cocaine, just lots of booze, shot after shot after shot, and just... I mean, there has been so many times I should have either gotten a DUI. I could have been raped multiple times. I mean, I could have been laying in the middle of the street and I didn't even care. I mean, there's times I woke up in people's yards, them kicking me like, hey, what are you doing here? You know, and I had no idea how I got there. And that went on for a year. And then Jay and I ended up getting back together, and he has loved my life. We are together to this day, and he asked me to marry him, and I said yes, and everything was great for a while there, and then I found out that he had cancer, and that was just like, man, just another thing, like, holy crap. And all this time too, I'm still trying to build a relationship with my father, which wasn't happening. So Jay and I had to go and down to a clinic and do all of his treatments and everything. That took about 6 to 8 months. Finished all of his treatments, and he thankfully went into remission. But during that time, the drinking never stopped. And it was just so selfish to me. I mean, I've got my man sick at home, but I get off work and I just go to every single bar, just one drink at one bar, and work my way home and just stop at every bar I could find on my way home. And then I got my man back there just sick as a dog and just didn't even want me to, I mean, didn't want me around. And, you know, I'd sleep on the couch and he'd have the room. And I was working really hard, but I also just couldn't deal with any more pain. And I just wanted to keep drinking and just numb it all. And then after he got better, When he got into remission, we ended up living at this campground for a little bit, like 3 months. The summer we lived at a campground. And then finally we were taken in by some people, and finally we had a bed to sleep on. After 3 months, we finally got to have our own bed to sleep on, and that was really nice. And from there, we kept building ourselves up, but my drinking never changed. My drinking was consistent. So it took us a long time to get where we are now. From this person's place, crashing at this person's place, renting for 1 year here, 1 year there. And finally, we're somewhere where we want to be. It's not all the way there yet, but we've been married for 3 years now, which is awesome. He is the love of my life. But me deciding to come here to treatment, it was a long time coming. It was a long, sad, crazy, nightmarish road. But I think Jay helped me a lot through it, and as I helped him, and is probably one of the most supportive people I could have. I mean, he always says, you know, you pushed me around in a wheelchair when I had cancer and I was sick. Now I'm gonna push your brain in a wheelchair and, you know, help you mentally and be there for you mentally and physically. And so I think I got the right man. I made the right decision, and I'm ready for us to just live our lives while we're still young and be healthy together and not drink. And especially with him, he can't drink with having, you know, with him having cancer. I don't know what I was thinking. Like, why would I be drinking with him if he has cancer? Like, that was the dumbest thing we could have done. But we did it anyways, because that's all we wanted to do, was just take pain away. And thankfully now we're both sober. I'll be 3 weeks sober on Tuesday, next Tuesday. That's the longest I've ever gone in since I was probably 13 years old. So 28 now to 13, that's a long time of being fucked up and almost dying and anything else in between. So I guess that's my story.
Well, good job, KP, pulling yourself together. I'm just thinking about the various factors that lead someone into addiction. And it sounds like there's community issues. Like, if the thing everybody does at night is get drunk, or if the thing everybody does is just take drugs, I mean, there's nothing to do, and that's what everyone's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's one factor. If there's people in the family struggling with addiction, that's another factor. If you get bullied in school, if you're a little bit different, if you have disease, or for whatever reason, you're a bit outcast, it's an enormous amount of emotional, psychological pressure.
Mm-hmm.
How does one deal with that? And then just being in a culture where problems really, there's no healthy ways to deal with problems, maybe through talking, therapy, arts. Like, there's ways to vent all the pain. If those options aren't available, like a good process, then it just builds up and it's hidden and it goes inward and gets toxic. And then, well, the remedy for that pain is drugs or alcohol. So what's the 5-year vision? What's the positive dream?
5-year vision right now is to buy a house with my husband, save money and buy a house and have a dog and, you know, go on vacations when we want to, take time off work when we want to, and just be happy and healthy and, you know, cook together, remodel the house together, you know, the little things, just enjoying the little things together instead of getting all sloshy and gross and not remembering anything.
Just a nice, simple life that's steady, that's wholesome.
Right.
You could enjoying the little things.
You could call it a boring life, but I'd rather have a boring life than putting my family through pain and suffering. And even though that same family has put me through pain and suffering, I can be stronger than that. And I can overcome it. And I will overcome it. You know, they call me a unicorn here because I came to a treatment facility on my own free will, and it's my first time. So I wanna make that true. I want to be the unicorn. I want to be the one that comes here on my own first time and doesn't ever come back. That is my goal, is to never come back to treatment ever again. And this is my one shot, and this is all I've got. And I'm putting everything, my heart, my mind, my soul, I'm trying everything I can do to make this work. And, you know, not just for myself, but, you know, for my husband and my mom and my dad and my brother and sister and my cousins, just, you know, the few friends I do have now. But, you know, those are the ones that I care about, and I want to make them proud. And my sweet grandma that, oh God, I mean, it makes me so proud that she's going to see me a whole different person, you know, before she is gone and becomes an ancestor. You know, she's going to see me as sober, and she's never seen any of her grandkids or her own children sober. And I wanna be that person to make a difference in my family.
Wow. The second time you were at the music meditation.
Yes, the second time music meditation, the music seemed light and like almost airy to me. And I saw, you know, up north where I'm from, it's about to be winter, and I saw, like, my nephews and my brother and sister and mom and husband just, like, laughing, having a good time, playing in the snow, you know, making snowmen and snow angels and just, you know, drinking hot cocoa and all that good shit together. And
this in your mind's eye.
My mind's eye.
A happy scene.
Very happy scene. But then it like flashed to like them all like crying, like sitting by a fire pit place, just like crying and just being sad. Like even my nephews, who are so small right now, and they were just all sad. And it was because like it showed me like this is what it can be. And this is what it can be, and this is what you have, you know? So the sadness was if I were to be gone, if I were to die from my addiction and my lifestyle, if I were to die, they'd still be happy in certain ways, but they'd also have so much sorrow in them, and I would never want that for my family. And seeing that was eye-opening too. I would never want my family to, you know, have a Christmas or New Year's without me, you know, not for a long, long time, you know. That was pretty amazing too.
Well, I feel very privileged to be able to facilitate and open a door so you can see these things. And this is just a truth you're seeing. It might not even be easy. It may be extremely difficult. But it's important to see the truth, to see what it is, to see what a happy family looks like and what a family looks like if tragedy happens.
Right.
So you were privileged to have that revelation, that insight. And wow, that's so happy you confided and shared so much of yourself today. Thank you so much, KP.
I hope it, any of your listeners, I hope they hear this story and they know that things can get better. You just have to try and believe in yourself. And it's going to be a hard road for the rest of your life, but it can still happen, and you can be happy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm Jewish, but this isn't about Hanukkah. It's about Christmas, because I love Christmas. Every year I get the same question. But you're Jewish. How can you enjoy Christmas? And I used to answer that it's the same way you can enjoy celebrating Hanukkah with your Jewish friends. But that got me blank stares, because anyone asking that question probably doesn't celebrate other people's holidays. Then last year I saw a meme that provided a much better answer. It's like celebrating someone else's birthday. It's not your birthday, but you can still enjoy the party. And who doesn't love a birthday party, other than introverts? Not only am I Jewish, but I grew up in Southern California. So I could dream of a white Christmas, but it's nothing like the one I used to know. When I was a kid, we'd go to Disneyland on Christmas, and it would be empty and totally decked out. They do such a great Christmas that now it's one of their busiest days of the year. So the Jewish secret is out. And then when I got older, I used to offer to work on Christmas, even take extra shifts so that people could be home with their families. Man, you get some serious appreciation that way, even though it wasn't really a sacrifice. Everyone would be in a good mood and all the bosses were at home. We got away with so much stuff. Thank God there was no YouTube in those days. I married a Goy and now we go to Ray's family for Christmas. So it's still like someone else's birthday party, but now it's like someone in the family. So have yourself a merry little Christmas. Or a big Christmas. Or Jewish Christmas, which is Chinese food in the movie. And if you want to celebrate Hanukkah with me, sorry, you're too late for this year. It came really early and it's already over. But hit me up for Passover this spring. I make a mean matzo ball soup.
Coming to the end of the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Gimme Some Sugar. Then I did an extended interview with KP at the New Spirit Recovery Center in Encino, and just wrapped it up with a short story by Sherry Cohen, a few words about Christmas. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!